Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Happy New Year. I hope you had a pleasant evening last night. We had a fondue party at KHOI last night and shared the company of comrades and good food. Here's hoping you had a good time, too. 2018. This week we bring in the new year with bright and cold weather. No break in the cold. Today's high is only expected to go up to 3 degrees, with wind chill factor dropping down as far as minus 40 degrees. Tuesday may go up to a balmy 12 degrees, but otherwise temperatures should stay pretty much below 10 degrees until Saturday, which has a predicted 22 degree high. Nights will remain below zero. We'll see lots of sun throughout the week, so it should be beautiful to look at, but be careful out there. Record-breaking freezing temperatures will persist throughout the week. Much of the country has been locked in to the record-breaking freeze as waves of cold air have been coming down from high altitudes, with 40 to 50 degrees below normal temperatures in the north-central parts of the United States. With all this cold, talk of the polar vortex and outbursts of the polar vortex have sprung up, and the last time this happened was in 2014. You remember that winter? It was really cold, too, I remember. At that time, KHOI reporter Susan Franson and I asked Elwin Taylor, ISU climatologist, to explain polar vortex and outbursts of polar vortex, and I wanted to share a segment of his explanation with you now. He started out by explaining the term Arctic front.
Arctic front, a new term for many people. The cold air that masses at the North Pole extends for a certain distance. And if you look down on the Earth from space, it would look like a pancake sitting on the North Pole that extends down about to the Arctic Circle. And the edge of that pancake is the edge of the bitterly cold and fairly dry, usually, Arctic air. And then the front doesn't stay in a perfect circle like a pancake. It sometimes gets waves on it and extremes. And so we just call the edge of that air mass the front. Front means the edge of a mass of air, whether they be warm fronts or cold fronts, or in this case, Arctic front. Normally, we talk about the southern extreme of polar air is the location of the Arctic front. It spends its time in northern Canada for most of the summer, and it often then establishes itself in Minnesota, and that degree of being north or south in the country for the winter. Occasionally, the Arctic front positioning itself over Iowa. There is a vortex at each pole, so it keeps the air from mixing outside of the polar area mostly. However, sometimes we have what we call polar outbreaks of cold air, where we get air very dry and starts off very cold as the air flows out of the high Arctic area into the Midwest. This would typically happen 2 or 3 times during a winter. During harsh winters, often the cold outbreaks would be 7 or 8 such. Occasionally, the outbreak of cold air, Arctic temperatures, makes it all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Occasionally beyond that. These are the freezes they worry about in the citrus area of Florida and Texas.
Polar vortexes is interesting to me because it's a phrase I never heard before this winter.
Somehow it became a buzzword. It is a low pressure, indeed, that did have origin in the high Arctic and did move into our area. So it's not deceitful, but it is new to almost everyone. It sounds like it will be the buzz term for a while now. Normally, I would say a strong low-pressure area is serving to draw air down from Canada into the Midwest, giving us the chill that we're experiencing. It is cold air and a low pressure. This moves slow, is almost a power unto itself, not associated necessarily with a front, except the ones that it itself is generating. It's massive and can sit still and be large for quite a period of time. The polar air is dry air because the amount of water that can be contained in the air is a temperature-dependent thing. The warmer the air, the more water it can hold. And so when we get warm air from the tropics coming up into the Midwest, it is usually very humid. And cold air from the Arctic that has been to a temperature as cold as 40 below zero, we consider dry air. It's not perfectly dry, but for all practical purposes, it is. So not a great deal of moisture comes from that air. However, when we have a condition of the cold air being heavier, sitting next to the ground, and warm air from the Gulf of Mexico that is humid, sliding up over the top of it, we have a boundary above our heads of where the cold air and the warm air meet, and precipitation begins with the warmer, wet air. It falls through the cold air near the surface. It gives us perhaps heavy snow, perhaps freezing rain. And this is the condition we've been seeing.
Elwin, is this cold air that we're talking about part of climate change?
Well, it is part of a changing climate, but I don't think we give necessarily blame or credit, as the case may be, for this type of an outbreak to human-influenced change of climate. This seems to go in a cycle of about 40 years, 20 years with harsher winters coming along occasionally, followed by 20 years or so of winters that tend to be mild, and has more to do with the wanderings of the currents in the oceans. The particular one we're talking about here is the where does the Gulf Stream go when it leaves the Gulf of Mexico? Sometimes it hugs very close to the eastern coast of the United States. Sometimes the Gulf Stream water ends up going almost on a beeline from Florida towards Spain and Portugal. Well, where its position has an effect on what we call the North Atlantic Oscillation. We have an index when this is greatly negative, often for 10 years or so in the winter. We have one kind of winters. When it's positive, we have another. We think we've gone into 20 years of a negative index when harsh winters, be they heavy snow, blizzards, or bitterly cold, any one of those can make it qualify as a harsh winter, or all of them combined, become more common. And as you might guess from what I've just said, if the winters are being harsh in the eastern half of the United States and adjacent Canada, they're probably being mild over in Europe. And that's exactly true. We like to say that New England and Old England have opposite types of winters.
And that was Elwin Taylor, ISU climatologist. Thank you to Elwin for his explanation of outbursts of the polar vortex. And now a few of the stories of Iowa in the National Front from iowainformer.com. Terry Branstedt returned to the state shortly before Christmas to attend the funeral of his 67-year-old brother, Monty. During the trip, Branstedt, who has served as the U.S. ambassador to China under President Trump since May, also attended the Iowa-China Business Forum in downtown Des Moines on December 22nd, where he discussed the efforts to contain North Korea's nuclear threat. He said, "I'm appreciative of the cooperation that we have had from China and the U.N. Security Council's resolution," referring to the North Korean dictator's violation of UN resolutions and continued testing of intercontinental ballistic missiles. At the forum, Branstedt reportedly claimed that the chemistry between Trump and the Chinese president was very good. However, he may have spoken too soon because relations have become complicated. On Thursday, Trump alleged on Twitter that China had been caught red-handed shipping oil into North Korea. Trump tweeted, "There will never be a friendly solution to the North Korea problem if this continues to happen. On Friday, the Chinese government responded by publishing a commentary in its state-run Global Times newspaper denying Trump's claim, which likely originated from a report Wednesday in a South Korean newspaper that Chinese ships had been caught delivering oil to North Korea roughly 30 times since October. Trump's administration pressured the international community to cease trade with the country in hopes of crippling its economy to negotiate on its weapons program, but numerous reports have recently suggested that China, Russia, and U.S. allies, including Germany, have continued to secretly trade with North Korea. On the health front, the Iowa Department of Human Services plans on January 8th to release a report on the initial impact a new family program is having on the state, according to the Associated Press. During the 2017 legislative session, Republican lawmakers chose to forego millions of dollars in federal funds in order to establish a new $3 million state-funded program, which excludes programs like Planned Parenthood, who in the past provided abortion services. This was despite the fact that no state or federal funds were ever previously used to pay for abortions. The January 8th report will analyze the new program's activities during the past first quarter of the fiscal year that began in July. The report will also focus on information about patient enrollment, program use, healthcare providers, and pharmacy and other service costs. After anti-abortion lawmakers cut off federal funding, Planned Parenthood in Iowa was forced to close four clinics in the state. Public opinions have showed that about three-quarters of Iowans still supported state or federal funding for the organization's non-abortive services. In a December 26 Facebook post, Iowa filmmaker Brent Roske announced that he was ending his campaign as an independent candidate for governor, citing changes in his personal life, including his marriage and wife's pregnancy, as well as the difficulty of running outside of the two-party system. Roske said he was glad to have been part of a conversation about cleaning up the state's polluted waterways and advocating for universal health care. Political activist Zach Walls, who rose to fame in 2011 when he spoke on the floor of the state House of Representatives in opposition to legislation that would have ended civil unions for LGBT couples, has announced that he will run for the state Senate seat of Coralville Democrat Bob Dvorsky, who doesn't plan to seek re-election next year. In Walls's speech to the House of Representatives, he described himself as, quote, raised by two women, unquote. And after the video of Walls' estate house speech went viral, his life changed dramatically. He has since written a book, My Two Moms, Lessons of Love, Strength, and What Makes a Family. He's made numerous national TV news appearances and co-founded Scouts for Equality, which advocates for LGBT rights in the Boy Scouts of America. He is now seen as the favorite to succeed Dvorsky and has already raised nearly $30,000 since announcing his bid for the seat. Democrat Janice Wiener, a 26-year-old U.S. retired diplomat, is also running for the District 37 seat. According to a report in the Des Moines Register, a newly released report showed that Iowa's three privatized Medicaid providers were assessed $1.5 million in penalties over the past 18 months for failing to comply with performance standards. $1.2 million were given to AmeriHealth Caritas, which recently terminated its contract with the state, claiming it was losing too much money providing health care services here in Iowa. Over the same period, two other providers were fined. Amerigroup was fined $146,486, and United Healthcare was fined $217,819. Since the program for low-income Iowans, which covers about a quarter of the state's insured patients, was privatized, Amerigroup has also announced that it will not take new patients. Since the new system was put into place, there have been growing complaints of reduced services, and several health officials told the Register that they had trouble even contacting AmeriHealth, leading to poor services and unpaid bills. And finally, the week before last, President Trump commuted the 27-year sentence of Shalom Rubashkin, who was convicted of money laundering and bank fraud after the 2008 federal immigration raid on his kosher meatpacking plant in Postville. During the raid, nearly 400 undocumented workers and their children were rounded up. Rubashkin was initially charged for undocumented workers as well, but was only convicted of money laundering and bank fraud. Writing for Slate, Mark Joseph Stern wrote that, quote, Donald Trump was absolutely right to commute his draconian and constitutionally defective sentence, but added, the only shame here is that Trump will almost certainly decline to grant clemency to other prisoners whose cases are just as egregious. To date, Rubashkin has served more than 8 years behind bars. And those are some of the stories where Iowa has been in the national news. Thank you to the Iowa Informer for the information. And if you want to learn more, you can go to iowainformer.com. And this is Local Talk. Here on KHOI Community Radio, I'm your host for today. Thank you for listening in.
The midnight bells are ringing. The ship is setting sail. The newborn baby crying as lovers say farewell.
Welcome back to Local Talk. As you probably know, the Federal Communications Commission recently revoked regulations known as net neutrality that ensure equal access to the Internet for everyone. Prior to this decision, Tom Miller, Iowa's Attorney General, was one of numerous attorney generals around the country who sent a letter to the FCC asking them to delay their net neutrality vote. Prior to the FCC's decision, there was a period of time allowed for public commentary, but the website of the Attorney General's office stated that a preliminary investigation by the New York Attorney General found a massive number of falsified public comments submitted to the FCC on the net neutrality issue, following growing evidence of a criminal effort to corrupt the FCC's comment process through large volumes of falsified public comments submitted to the agency. Attorney General Tom Miller joined 17 attorney generals in asking the Federal Communications Commission to delay its net neutrality rulemaking. According to the New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, a preliminary analysis showed that as many as 2 million comments misused the identities of real Americans. A careful review of publicly available information revealed a pattern of fake submissions using the names of real people. In fact, there may have been over 1 million fake submissions from across the country. This is akin to identity theft on a massive scale. The Pew Research Center analysis of the nearly 22 million public comments on net neutrality submitted to the FCC found that the vast majority were repeats, with more than 75,000 comments submitted at the exact same second on 9 different occasions, possibly indicating that these were automated submissions, such as in organized bot campaigns. After the FCC proceeded with their decision to revoke net neutrality regulations, Iowa Attorney General tweeted on December 14th, "Our office will consult with other state attorney generals in the wake of the FCC decision to repeal net neutrality. It's likely there will be a multi-state legal challenge." Attorney General Miller was not available last week, but we were able to speak with Benjamin Billis, Assistant Attorney General for Consumer Protection in the Office of the Attorney General. We asked them about Attorney General Miller's actions and what the office is planning to do.
On the 13th of December, he and 17 other attorneys general sent a letter to the FCC asking them to hold off on the 14th on changing the rule. The gist of that letter was mostly that when the agencies change rules like this, they often will take public comments and they let people add their input, and the idea is that they will factor in what the businesses say, what the industry says, what the consumers say, and that kind of stuff. There were a lot of comments that came in on the change to the rule here, and it was discovered that over 2 million of them at that point were fraudulent, that they weren't even real people, or they were basically stealing the identity of people out there who didn't agree with it and using them to try and change the rule. Within like a couple of days, we're to over 24 million now of fake commentaries brought in here.
How do you tell that a comment is fake?
Well, there's algorithms, but a big part of it was that people just called in and complained. Because you can go check on this on the New York Attorney General's office website and find out whether or not there was a comment made by you. And people went and checked. We had people call in our office. I even saw one that was allegedly done in the name of Barack Obama, which it's unlikely since it was his administration that did the 2015 rule.
It's pretty brazen to use Barack Obama's name.
We had people calling us. We even had some people in our office that were shocked to find their names being used to file commentaries against net neutrality. And so part of the deal was just, well, there's something fundamentally wrong with this process when we know that this many are fraudulent, so we need to step back and look at this and make the analysis based on what we can of the facts. And they asked the FCC to hold off based on that. And then after the fact, there are several groups out there that are entertaining, you know, various approaches here. I mean, I know that Congress is talking about doing what's taking an order under the Congressional Review Act, and that basically says that Congress has the power to reverse an administrative order like this within 60 days after it's implemented. And, of course, I don't know what's going to happen with that, if anything. The other thing is there are various groups, industries, companies, and things like that that are also considering legal challenges. And Attorney General Miller and several of his peers are, of course, discussing that and probably will take place in some kind of multi-state action to challenge these rules on several levels when the time comes.
Now, the Attorney General of New York has already indicated he intends to lead a lawsuit against the FCC.
Yes, he has.
The Iowa Attorney General, Tom Miller, is deciding whether to join that lawsuit or not?
That one, or there may be others out there, too. The decision's not been made yet. Part of the deal is that while the order has been issued, there isn't a copy of it out there to look at yet, so nobody's really sure what the claims will be. We know the gist of it from a draft order that everybody saw, but we don't yet know what the final order is going to look like, and that will be part of the reason how we decide which way we're going to go.
Do you have a sense of the timetable? Is this a decision that will be made within the next month or within the next half year, or how do things like this play out?
Once the order drops, the initial draft probably will be done, probably made within 10 days, with more filings after that. So it's all contingent on how soon the final order gets posted.
Nobody's been able to change their behavior yet, right? So when my computer crashes, it's not because net neutrality has been revoked.
Right. And you never know what's going to happen. I mean, the ISPs have done it in the past before the rules got enacted, but you don't know they're going to do it for sure. I think it'd be unwise for any ISP to do anything too drastic until this whole thing's resolved, because the last thing you would want to do would be to have consumers mad and making complaints to the FCC while this thing's all still pending.
You said you got a lot of calls. What kind of comments did you get?
The vast majority were people who were upset about the net neutrality rule being revoked. People's internet access is a big, big part of their life. That's how we all communicate. People really, really seem to have got into this, and a lot of people really, really understand it, and we've gotten an awful lot of passion.
Could you explain in a nutshell who exactly the FCC are, since they are the people that repealed net neutrality?
Well, the Federal Communications Commission is a federal agency.
Located in Washington, D.C.
Yes. And they do control wireless communication, telecommunication, that kind of thing. And it's their mandate to make the rules for how our country processes those services out there, and hopefully to monitor them, make sure that they're done to the benefit of the consumers and the citizens of the country, as well as the industries of the country. it's overseen by three commissioners that are placed there by the President of the United States. They make the primary decisions on what the agency does, and then you have divisions who do various things out there and regulate various things out there.
So the decision to repeal net neutrality was made by these three commissioners.
Right.
Can you describe briefly what exactly these protective regulations are that make up net neutrality?
Net neutrality basically is the principle that the internet service providers, which we all call ISPs, can't do things like speeding up, slowing down, or blocking content, websites, applications people want to use.
The ISPs are the companies that provide the technology that make us connected to the web, right? They're not the websites themselves. They're kind of like the equivalent of what telephone lines used to be, right?
That's exactly right. All those guys that you go to access the internet with, such as AT&T and Mediacom, Comcast, Verizon. If the internet was a highway, they'd be the people that were letting you access for the internet.
Net neutrality was a set of rules that made sure that everybody had equal access.
Right. The FCC was regulating the internet pretty hands-off under what was called Title I of the Communications Act of 1934, and they were treating them with, as what's called an information service. And then the FCC changed that with what's called the Open Internet Order, and they reclassified the internet under Title II of the Act as a common carrier. And basically that common carrier class is things that include things, like you said, the telephone and things like that. And that meant that there were things that these companies could not do. They couldn't do things like what's called like throttling, blocking, or prioritizing the internet service.
What does that mean? It sounds like a football game.
In a way, it might be. Basically, you just couldn't get to where you wanted to go on the internet. Blocking is where the ISP would go in and just prohibit the consumer from connecting to a lawful destination on the internet. They could block content, application services. And then throttling is another way it would interfere with the quality of the internet service. They might do a slowdown or intentionally slowing down the speed of the internet service or blocking the transfer of certain kinds of files. And then prioritization basically is just where you say that they can't accept money to give priority over one service over another. In other words, they can't take more money so that Netflix gets better service for its customers than a competitor would be out there.
What exactly would be the reason to block or throttle it? Why would that even occur?
It would occur because they might get paid to do it. They would make a profit off that if they gave somebody access or better service that way.
Creating a gateway that
right.
People would have to pay to get better service.
Right, and keep from getting worse service. Some companies did it because they didn't like the content. Might be political, or some just, they had their own services they wanted to get people to buy, so they didn't want a competitor to get access, or they took money from somebody to get better access. I mean, there's all these reasons out there they might do it. Like Netflix could be blocked so people can access Netflix.
Unless they paid to access it.
Right.
So this essentially can happen now because net neutrality has been repealed, right?
That's correct.
So what was the justification used for repealing net neutrality by the Federal Communications Commission?
Their justification basically was that it was too heavy-handed in the regulation, that competition would take care of it. They say that letting it go back the way it was will help competition increase because it will give incentive to companies to invest more in their products and their services and that kind of thing.
So it's like a free market argument.
Exactly. And I just want to make a point here just to make it understand why this matters all the way around is, and this is a twofold problem where consumers can't get equal access necessarily, but it's also where providers of information and products on the internet might not be able to compete either. So what you have is the big company might just pay the money so that the little startup couldn't compete even if they had a better product. And I also want to just make it clear that net neutrality recognizes that we use the internet for things more than just buying things off Amazon. I mean, we now use it to access medical care, and we use it to educate our children. There was a commentary a while back pointing out the fact that the internet has done a lot to level the playing field between inner-city poor kids and kids going to better schools, because now the inner-city schools that don't have so much money can access the internet and help educate their children. And this would even interfere with that kind of service.
You're saying that internet has become part of public safety and welfare of our society as a whole.
And that's part of the deal. Some people that say that this is okay just kind of treat it like it's some kind of advertising scheme. I saw one analogy where they said basically this would be like somebody telling a grocery store that they can't advertise a certain product or accept money from a certain product to put it like on an end cap or something like that. But the approach taken here is the fact that, no, the internet is actually something much more than just an advertising scheme or a way to sell merchandise. It's a fundamental way of our life, just like it would be for our telephone service or our utility service or things like that.
Is the Attorney General's office receptive to input from the public at this point?
Well, we're always interested in what consumers think, and I'll be frank with you that we actually got an awful lot of calls on this. I mean, much higher than we normally get for any one subject out here, so people seem to be passionate about it. We will always talk to people about it, and we'll take their calls about it, but the real impact is if you call your representatives in the Congress and you call the FCC and make your comments there. Congress does have 60 days that they could actually do something about this if they wanted to. It all depends on who comes to play on it. I mean, it all depends a lot of times on the input and the parties that get involved. It does depend on people contacting the people who can make the decisions also.
When Attorney General Tom Miller sent this letter to the FCC and indicated publicly that he was considering being part of an action against the FCC, did he get any pushback from the Iowa legislature or the Iowa governor?
Not to my knowledge.
I think only 17 attorney generals in a country of 50 states wrote this letter to the FCC. Why did he decide to step forward?
Mr. Miller has always felt very strongly about consumer protection, and he's been a leader in many, many cases, whether it was the mortgage crisis we had earlier or telemarketing scams. He's been on the forefront of all these things for years, and it's just something he believes very passionately in. It's always been done for the right reasons. I mean, and I know it sounds trite, but I'm just really, really pleased to be working here because I like what I do, and he's the reason why. He's been our AG for many, many, many years. In fact, I think he's tied for the longest-serving state attorney general in the country. I have dealt with him for, I think, 17, 18 years now, and I've done consumer protection for him all this time. And I've sat in meetings with him where he heard about things were being done to people, and it was almost startling sometimes. It wasn't just that we had to do something. It's like, we have to do it now, start marching. He sincerely is concerned about people.
We're speaking with Ben Bellis, who is with the Attorney General's Office, Assistant Attorney General for Consumer Protection. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for your interest, and I want to thank people for actually caring about what goes on with this, both consumer work itself and with the net as a larger part of it.
And again, that was Ben Bellum, Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Consumer Affairs for the state of Iowa. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour. Happy New Year. And this being the first Monday of the month, Bronwyn Beatty Hansen is here, City Council Member at Large for the City of Ames. And she is here for her monthly City Council check-in. And Dennis Hart is once again here to discuss all things City Council with her. Dennis Hart is our Ames Municipal Reporter, although he actually right now lives in California. Bronwyn and Dennis actually got together last Friday to record this discussion. So let's listen in. At the beginning, you're going to hear Evan Taylor, our operations manager, connecting Dennis by telephone.
Hello.
Hello, Dennis. Hey, this is Evan at KHOI. Are you ready to do your interview with Bronwyn today?
Evan, I am more than ready. And how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for asking.
Well, you had a white Christmas. That's beautiful. You know, I wish I were there. Inside the studio, of course, not outside.
All righty. Bronwyn's here. I will go ahead and turn it over to her.
Hi, Dennis.
Hey, thanks for coming in on a snowy, cold day. Happy New Year to you.
Oh, thank you. You too.
All right, so here we go. As always, the council has a considerable number of things on its plate this coming year, and among the very first things, of course, is that issue of the rental occupancy ordinance. You've passed two readings of a new ordinance, which is needed because the state did away with the city's ability to regulate on the basis of three unrelated adults and one family. And now you have a new ordinance that you've had two readings on. Third reading scheduled for January 9th. Do you see that passing in its current form, or could there be changes coming on the 9th?
If there would be any changes, I can't imagine they'd be too significant because we are so far into the process and we've already had the two readings. I think, no, I would doubt anyone has the will to change that ordinance drastically at this point.
Where does the ordinance stand as it's written right now? What does it say?
Basically, if you have a one or a two or a three bedroom rental property, again, a house, individual house, not apartment or anything like that, but houses we're talking. One, two, or three bedroom can have up to three adults. Four bedrooms can have four adults. Five bedrooms can have five adults. And an upwards cap of five. So if you have a six-bedroom house, for some reason, you still can only have five adults. We did require some parking, too. So in those one, two, and three-bedroom units, two parking spots required off the street on those, and then four and five bedroom units would be required to have one per person, one parking spot off the street per person in order to get that occupancy.
What about the provision in the ordinance, as I understand it, that after next April 30th, this coming April 30th, owners, landlords can add parking spaces?
Yes, that's true. We did add that provision. Basically, you know, say someone's got a three-bedroom house right now, but they only have, oh, let's say, one parking space for, or none, you know. Actually, some properties, that are being used currently as rental properties right now have been grandfathered in with no off-street parking. So we want to provide a way to sort of mitigate the negative impacts on those folks that might have less parking than they need and have been able to have three unrelated people at this point. So that's sort of to mitigate that, basically.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from Campus Town neighborhoods? The ordinance, new ordinance, would essentially allow two more people in a rental than the one that is expiring allowed. In other words, going from three to five. What's been the reaction to that?
From what I understand, they're fairly satisfied with the ordinance in its current form. I mean, it does logically make some sense that if you do have a four or five bedroom house, you know, you should be able to use those bedrooms. And so they will see some increase in population, I think, in the highly rental areas. But on the other hand, we do need to, as a city, we do need to basically increase density in the core gradually over time, as opposed to sprawling. Those are really the two methods of city growth. So I think this is kind of a happy medium. I mean, they will get some more population, of course, in that area. But hopefully we'll figure out some ways to stabilize those neighborhoods as we look at overlays. That'll be one of the things we're looking at in this new year that I think will be really important and probably a hefty discussion. And that's the concept of a rental overlay. So say you have a neighborhood, let's just use South Campus as an example. If we go with an overlay concept, we would set a percentage of rentals that that area couldn't exceed. So say I'm just picking a number. This is not what I have no concept that this is what we go with. But say we say 50%. So you can't have more than 50% of the homes in a given geographical area. You can't have more than 50% rental. So once you hit that 50% rental cap, no new rental permit might be issued for that geographic area.
Hasn't that already been done in other parts of the city historically?
I don't know that we have an example of that.
It would be something new for the city then.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, other cities do it. And so we've seen some examples of other college towns and just other cities that have employed this method. But no, Ames doesn't have any examples yet.
One quick question procedurally. The council had an opportunity in December to either have a third reading the same night you had the second reading or have a special meeting. In other words, get the thing passed before the old ordinance, the existing ordinance back then, expired.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't the council do that?
Well, I don't think that we felt that the difference between January 1st, when the old ordinance expires, and the 9th, I think, when our next meeting is, we didn't feel like people would be really rushing out in that week time frame to make changes that we wouldn't like to see. So we didn't see a big risk, that difference in time, I think.
Another major issue coming up right away for you folks on the council. Next few weeks, you're going to have to establish a budget for the 2018-2019 fiscal year. What is, as we speak right now, the city's financial situation as we go into these budget discussions? Are we in good shape?
I think yes. You know, Ames is fiscally healthy traditionally. I would say, though, that there are some things we're looking ahead to that are just things we'll need to keep an eye on. One of the biggest financially would be the state a few years ago did a property tax overhaul. They allowed for cities to get a property tax backfill from the state sort of to reduce the impact of that change in property taxes at the time. And that's quite a large sum of money, millions of dollars. And the state legislature has made noises that in future years, they're kind of indicating that the state might need those funds. Then we have to think about how we'll make up the difference.
Well, the obvious next question is, how could you make up the difference?
Really, the only way would be an increase in the property tax rate. Not a loved subject, so we would be very hesitant to do that. But of course, if you have less money coming in, you're either looking at reduced services or tax increases. And so I think, you know, it'd be a balance of the two, I suppose.
Yes, I didn't want to be the one to bring up the key word taxes.
Yeah.
Early in the year. I'm glad you brought it up. What are your priorities for this budget year? What would you like to see go into the budget?
I think the thing that we often look at a lot is the CIP, the Capital Improvements Project budget. And that's where we see projects like the extension of Grand and other infrastructure projects. And those are ones that I like to keep an eye on. You know, not only Grand, the extension of that, which will be in the CIP for the next 5 years, but also a big priority for me, too, is just making Ames more pedestrian-friendly, more multimodal, basically. I like to look at where we're putting in sidewalks and shared use paths, where we need to connect routes that maybe have a gap. I think that's an important thing for us to look at.
this year, you're going to be discussing a complete streets plan. It's complex. It is difficult to get a full handle on what this means. What would a complete streets plan mean for the city and for the residents?
A complete streets plan is one that helps form our decisions in a way that hopefully will build a better transportation network for all users and not just one type of user. So it means that when you're looking at streets, you see what improvements maybe could be made for pedestrian access or bicycle access or bus access. But it doesn't mean that we put a bike path on every street. I think that that is a common misconception about complete streets. It just means that when we're looking at our transportation system as a whole, we want to make sure we have several healthy east-west routes for bicycles through town, several healthy north-south routes, same with cars, pedestrian access. It doesn't mean that we have to put a bike trail on every single east-west street, but we need to have good, strong routes that people can take, get across town in an efficient way.
Lincoln Way is certainly the major east-west street. How would a complete street plan impact that in terms of a possible bike lane or more on Lincoln Way?
Some parts of Lincoln Way could probably use some improvement in pedestrian and or bicycle access. We have the Lincoln Way corridor study that we'll be using to help kind of guide how we look at Lincoln Way as well. But I think Lincoln Way is probably not a prime example of a great bicycling route just because of the high traffic volumes. So we do have some shared use paths along Lincoln Way, but I think my own preference or feeling would be that we'd be better off picking parallel routes to that to really strengthen biking systems. There are parts on Lincoln Way, though, you know, where sidewalks can be pretty treacherous and narrow right now, even for pedestrians. So I think that would be a good focus along Lincoln Way, too.
As if you don't have enough going already, you are in the process, the city, of revamping the current land use plan that was adopted 20 years ago and would never anticipated Ames growing nearly as fast as it has, primarily because of Iowa State. How could this new land use plan change the city?
That's an interesting one because it does frame when we look at annexation requests and zoning change requests and things like that. The new plan we'll embark on is what they call a comprehensive plan. So not only land use in terms of zoning and preferred use, but it would also incorporate our transportation plan and our, you know, all the other plans that we currently have out there. The comprehensive plan is meant to really tie them all together. So it's quite a big undertaking, actually.
Well, it's a major undertaking. And in terms of the public having input, how can or will members of the public be able to talk about this?
There will definitely be public input sessions throughout the process. And then, of course, the public can respond when council gets reports back about the status of the project. You know, I think we're a little bit behind in terms of our timeline for the comprehensive plans with rental occupancy. So, yeah, things come up all the time, too. It's kind of interesting how that happens. But, yeah, there'll be plenty of public input opportunities, probably both online and in person as we get that process rolling.
Do you anticipate the plan being voted on in a final form sometime this year?
No. I think it'll take longer.
Long term.
Yeah, I think it'll take much longer than that to come up with a plan. I would think a 2-year process, maybe.
One of the real major push points, as you know, because the council voted on something involving this just a couple of weeks ago, is the push for more development in the western part of the city, primarily apartments, primarily student occupancy. Is the plan going to address this?
Definitely. I mean, that I think the land use plan currently, that's its goal, is to kind of guide where and how the city grows. And so as we develop this new plan, that'll be a big focus of it, yeah. Determining where density increases are needed or not needed, or where we have enough infrastructure to support the services of more density.
The Western push, the Western development push for student housing is a big issue seemingly always before the council. Is it a given that that's where the development has to take place in Ames in terms of students and housing? I mean, is it just going to be a Western expansion?
I don't know that it's a given necessarily. There are properties already in the Southwest that are converting to student apartment, you know, kind of off Mortenson where they are currently. But farther than that, I don't know that it's a given necessarily. You know, we talk a lot about students wanting to be close to campus, too. So I think we try to find a balance of ways to increase student living opportunities kind of in the core of the city so that we don't have as many driving and things like that. So that's kind of a priority too, for me at least. Can't speak for the rest of council.
Can't let the new year go by without talking about the Healthy Life Center. Everybody is going to be talking about it this year because you've got some studies going on, and this is going to be a potential big budget, big construction item here. Talk about exactly what that center would be and how Ames residents could interact with it. In other words, what is a Healthy Life Center?
And yeah, it's a really neat concept. It's very exciting to think about. It would basically be a space where we would have, you know, gymnasium, indoor pool, walking track, activity rooms, that kind of thing. And the idea is that it could be sort of multi-generational. You could have different agencies using that space. You could have Heartland Senior Services using that space, and you could have Iowa State maybe using it for internships, or, you know, there are opportunities there. You could have therapeutic uses that Mary Greeley might draw on. So the idea is to, yeah, have this community wellness center where different agencies could use it, different partners, but then also, you know, the main use would be the general public coming in and using the gym, using the swimming pool, using the walking track in weather like this. The only place currently to go for that sort of thing is the mall in terms of walking exercise.
One estimate that we've all heard on the cost comes from Parks and Rec Director Keith Abraham. He says it might cost $50, $51 million. My guess is you don't have that in your pocket this morning, and I certainly don't. Where would the money come from potentially for that?
That's the hard part. Any great dream like this comes with a big price tag. We would try to drum up private funding, donations. I think it would need to pass a bond, a public referendum. That'll be interesting as we move through the process to see how much that referendum total might end up being.
How quickly might this move through the process?
If we're going to move ahead with it, hopefully we would know within the next year or two what's feasible. And if it goes much beyond that, probably the chances of it happening diminish over time.
Is there anything else you would like to see happen or bring to the table for the council, for the city, for this coming year?
One of the meetings that we have annually is our goal-setting session. One of the things that I think is interesting, and that is coming up, we have it on two Saturdays in January. It's the 13th and the 20th from 8 a.m. or so to mid-afternoon. That's out at the Gateway Hills Park. The Parks and Rec office is out there. Of course, it's a public meeting, you know, but I would say in the past, it's not as well attended as council meetings, which is interesting to me because I view it as very important. Once we set our goals for the year, then we are constantly referring to those in council meetings, and it really guides what we focus on and where we put our energy. So the results of those two sessions, I think, are quite important for how we shape our year.
Indeed. We're out of time. Happy New Year to you, Bronwyn.
Oh, thank you. Happy New Year to you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And thank you to Dennis Hart and Bronwyn Beatty Hansen for the monthly update on the Ames City Council. This is Local Talk. Happy New Year. Haven't gotten tired of saying that yet. And I would like to personally, as the station manager, express my sincere gratitude to you if you are among the many people who donated to KHOI during the past 2 months. The time between November and December is crucial for KHOI to arrange for operating funds for the coming year, and we sincerely appreciate every single donation. We are going to basically now stop pitching on the air, but before we do so, just wanted to remind you that we still are happy to receive donations. Just go to our website at khoyfm.org. Well, I thought we would go out with turning our attention back to the topic that we started this show with, the winter weather and the snow. What better way to do that than to look at the animals who are out there in the snow in their fur coats? So here's Patch Larbaum to talk about the river otters.
Today's focus on phenology is about Iowa's river otters. Be watching for their tracks and slides in the snow. River otters are the one critter in all creation that seems to have fun all the time. Otters enjoy everything in life, and they are once again present for all Iowans to enjoy. From their lope across land, humping along like a fur-covered slinky toy, to their movements through water, undulating with sleek porpoising motions, otters move through life with amazing grace. Otters have always been a highly desirable and coveted mammal. They are extremely shy and elusive of humans. With the snow and freezing conditions, it's that time of year, their familiar dot-dash-dot pattern of hopping and sliding and hopping, and then sliding and then hopping along the ice and leaving their tracks and slides through the snow. In 1804, Meriwether Lewis of Lewis and Clark fame wrote about his first encounter with otters. The color is a uniform dark brown, and when in good order and good season, perfectly black and glossy. It is the richest, and I think the most delicious, fur in the world. At least I cannot form an idea of any more so. It is deep, thick, silky in the extreme, and strong. The inner part of the fur, when open, is lighter than the surface in its natural position. There are some fine black and shining hairs intermixed with the fur, which are rather longer and add much to its beauty. Meriwether Lewis on River Otters. As Iowa was settled by the pioneers, river otters were removed by overexploitation and habitat loss. The last river otter in Iowa was in Woodbury County along the Missouri River in 1929. Ironically, this was near the site that Meriwether described the first otter that he had seen on their voyage of discovery. Over the decades, there were a few otters noted along the Mississippi River in northeast Iowa that were entangled in fishing nets. However, river otters did not pioneer or move on their own into suitable habitat like other rejuvenated species like bald eagles or bobcats. It seemed that areas that had river otters historically would never have otters again. Then things changed for the better in 1985. A trade was made to bring river otters to Iowa from an otter-rich area in Louisiana. 32 Iowa wild turkeys were sent to Kentucky that obtained 16 river otters from Louisiana to send to Iowa. The otters were placed in the backwaters of Red Rock Reservoir south of Des Moines. They survived their first winter admirably, and it can be noted that the same genetic makeup of the fur that keeps an Iowa otter warm in winter will keep the Louisiana otters cool in the summer. Over the next decade or so, 220 river otters were brought to Iowa and released in the ratio of 10 males and 10 females at 12 sites around the state. From those efforts, river otters have now rejuvenated the waters in all 99 of Iowa counties. Otters have been noted along the Des Moines River in central Iowa. In the 1990s, otters were placed in the Chautauqua area of Polk County, downstream from Ames, on the Skunk River. From those placements, river otters have been noted at McFarland Lake and Peterson Pits in north-central Story County. Recently, in a southern Iowa woodland, a river otter passed right through the trees for all the world to see. I was being pretty quiet, and it took my breath away. It took 30 years, but I got to see an otter where I grew up near Garden Grove between the Weldon and the Jonathan Rivers. I'd read that otters can go overland, away from water, and this was a prime example. And wow, it was the blackest otter I've ever seen. I'd been working on this phenology, and then to see one flowing through the trees, well, sometimes in life you can't make this stuff up. Unlike other mammals that hibernate or take long sleep cycles in winter, river otters remain very active. Their familiar dot-dash-dot pattern of hopping and sliding through the snow and leaving their tracks are a joy to discover, and it's a joy to realize that the highly cherished river otters are with us once again. We're pretty sure Meriwether Lewis would get a kick out of that. And this is Pat Schlarbaum with a phonology for today.
Thank you, Pat Schlarbaum. And you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we also heard a roundup of Iowa in the national news from the Iowa Informer, iowainformer.com. Benjamin Bellum, Assistant Attorney General in Consumer Affairs, spoke with us about net neutrality. Dennis Hart spoke with Bronwyn Beatty Hansen about upcoming issues for the Ames City Council, and Elwyn Taylor gave us an explanation of polar vortex and outbursts from polar vortex and Arctic circles. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' from Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley, and we also heard Bon Jovi with New Year's Day. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Please remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful. If you were not listening, I would just be a person in a very nice room in downtown Ames, speaking to myself. Thank you for listening, and we will see you again on the radio, and Happy New Year. Said it one more time.